Hello and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. Our guest is Frank Decatur, author of China After Mao, The Rise of a Superpower. Frank, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Thank you for having me.
Mao Zedong died in 1976, and since then, China has reformed and opened up, fueling its economic transformation. At least that's the story we're often told. Frank, what do you think?
I think we may have noticed, at least some of us, that there hasn't been an awful lot of political reform. I think that was pretty clear when in 1989, some 200 tanks and 100,000 soldiers converged on the heart of Beijing to crush the population. And that commitment to a monopoly over power hasn't changed. But what is so interesting is that we still talk about economic reform as if there is somehow a change from the plan to the market, from state enterprises towards the private sector, when that, in fact, too, is also very questionable. At heart, what we have seen is tinkering with a model. And what is that model? Well, a model is a commitment to a socialist economy. It says so in the Constitution, uphold the socialist way, uphold the leadership of the Communist Party. What is the socialist way? Well, in Marxist terms, it really means that the party wishes to keep control over the means of production, which is the land, which still belongs to the state, which is the banks, which still belong to the states, etc., etc.
Are you saying there's been no economic reform, or just not the kind of economic reform we may imagine has taken place?
Oh, there's been change. But you got to remember, none of these regimes are frozen in time. From Lenin all the way till the fall of the Soviet Union with Khrushchev and de-Stalinization, there was great change in the Soviet Union too, but it remained very much a socialist economy. And my argument here is very much the same. We are in the People's Republic of China, and it remains a People's Republic dominated by the Communist Party. So there's enormous change. There's no way you could compare China to today with the China of even 20 years ago, never mind 40 years ago. But underneath is the iron hand of the party that keeps control over the economy. So to talk about a market economy or to talk about a private sector is pretty misguided when the hand of the state is everywhere.
You have a line in the preface to your book, China After Mao, and I just want to quote it. Thanks to financial repression, ordinary people's share of the national output is the lowest of any country in modern history, unquote. I would have thought a different country has this dishonor. Why is it so bad in China?
It's an interesting quotation you mentioned there, because yet again it points at continuities between, if you wish, the Mao era and the post-Mao era. Of course, China today is so different, with these skyscrapers everywhere and bullet trains and modern airports, at least in the cities. Countryside remains piss poor. But the whole point really is that the share of ordinary people of GDP remains one of the lowest in world history, in modern history. In other words, whatever is produced, the majority of that goes to the state, not to ordinary people. You got to remember that to this day, children in the countryside are unable to afford reading glasses. Fewer children in the countryside go to school when compared to India and Africa.
You also quote a Chinese saying, quote, the state is rich, the people are poor, unquote. Do a lot of ordinary Chinese people say that to each other?
Yeah. Well, that's it in a nutshell. Which China, of course, we're talking about what is really, in effect, almost an apartheid state, with wealth in the cities and people classified as city dwellers, and vast numbers of people in the countryside legally classified through the household registration system, which in fact goes back to the internal passport set up by Stalin back in the 1930s, are classified as peasants, and they really are second class citizens. So yes, they are the poor ones, and they have to look at all the wealth being accrued by the state. Needless to say that these very people, whether they're on the cities or on the countryside, have to save, and their savings go into state banks, and the state decides what happens with their savings.
You began by noting that there's been no political reform, no real political reform or freedom in China. For decades, people who were hopeful about the development of China would say, well, we'll have the economic reform first. And once we have economic reform, we'll get to political freedom. That seems never to have happened. But is this the fundamental failure that there's been no genuine economic reform?
Well, it's not a failure. You got to remember that from 49 all the way till now, in particular, after 1989, there's been fear of foreign things and foreign ideas. And this becomes, from 1989 onwards, there's a term given to this, namely peaceful evolution, the idea that the capitalist camp out there has a plot, and that plot is called peaceful evolution, namely help China to develop economically in the hope that it will somehow one day transition peacefully towards a democratic system. But that is seen by the regime, by Jiang Zemin in 89, by Jiang Zemin again in 99, by Hu Jintao in 2009, and by Xi Jinping in 2019, is seen as an attempt to really subvert power and overthrow the Communist Party of China. So they're very much opposed to it. So this is what happens. Every time you have one of your presidents, say Bill Clinton or George Bush, or a foreigner like Merkel, say that we must help China because with economic reform, one day there will be a transition towards democracy, they are in effect offering all the evidence the regime needs that these foreigners are out there to overthrow the Communist Party of China.
So what are China's ambitions? Does it seek to join the community of nations and live in peace with everybody, or is it something else?
It is a socialist country. In other words, it is a Leninist, a Marxist-Leninist state. In the constitution, it says so very clearly. It is a dictatorship of the proletariat. If you don't know what that means, think of the opposite. From the point of view of a Marxist-Leninist state, there are dictatorships of the proletariat, and they're opposed to a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, that is you and me. In other words, there's an imperialist camp out there, which is seen as being driven by a desire to overthrow the socialist system in China and replace the Communist Party with a democratic system. That is the belief, not entirely unfair, I should say. So it is a vision which is very dualistic, one based on opposition to something that surrounds it, an imperialist camp. It used to be, of course, there used to be a socialist camp with the Soviet Union, but that disappeared in 1991. It crumbles, as you know. So from that point onwards, the slogan until the collapse of the Soviet Union in China, the slogan was only socialism can save China. From 1991 onwards, the slogan becomes only China can save socialism. So that's the mission, socialism.
How stable is China today? You mentioned the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. Those were crushed. We've seen more recently protests over COVID-19 lockdowns and restrictions. How stable is the regime right now?
It's a very difficult question. First of all, I don't study China today. I'm a historian, as you know. But the key point really is that these regimes, by that I mean one-party states, whether it's Nazi Germany or Italy under Mussolini, or of course the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, invest massive resources into projecting an image of power and stability. And then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and you realize the Soviet Union is gone, it's crumbled. And I wouldn't say that this is likely to happen with the People's Republic, but you got to remember that there's a great contrast between that image of stability and what goes on underneath the surface. And we had a taste of that when ordinary people in the cities stood up and spoke out against these endless, relentless, mindless lockdowns, with the result that it actually forced the regime to back off entirely. We have the exact opposite. From complete lockdown, now we have no control whatsoever. So from one extreme to the other, and I would say to some extent that characterizes a lot of one-party states. Policy decisions that go from one extreme to another.
One more question. You're an historian. You're the author of a remarkable trilogy of books about China under Mao. Now you have this new book, China After Mao, The Rise of a Superpower, which takes us to the year 2012. As you look back on this period of Chinese history, what kind of advice do you have for Western policymakers as they think about the problem of China?
Well, I would say read the Constitution. Read the Constitution of the People's Republic of China, in particular, the four cardinal principles, which are repeated year in, year out by every single leader. Last time this happened was in October 22, a few months ago, at the 20th Party Congress. What are the four cardinal principles? Uphold the socialist way. Uphold the leadership of the Communist Party. Uphold the dictatorship of the proletariat, and uphold Mao Zedong thought, Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. If you understand the extent to which the regime is committed to that, you understand this entity much better.
The author is Frank Decotter. The book is China After Mao, The Rise of a Superpower. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to all of you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.